Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Here's the question that we will try to take up this morning in the first hour of the show. When does history begin? Now, maybe you ask that question to a lot of people, historians particularly. They will say, well, history begins when people start to write things down. And in fact, most of the books that are used in Western civilization courses begin at the point where people indeed start to write things down and do things like build cities and work metal. But certainly we know there were people around for a long time before that point. And the question is, well, what can we know about human history before history? That is, what can we know about prehistory? That is a question that is very interesting and one that is of interest to our guest for this part of Focus 580. His name is Daniel Lord-Small. He is a professor of history at Harvard University. His area includes medieval European history, but also this question here, that is something called deep history, early global history. That's a subject that he takes up in his book On Deep History and the Brain. It is available in paperback, published by the University of California Press. So if you're interested in looking at the book, you can seek it out. Also, if you're interested in hearing more on this subject from him, he is here visiting the campus and will give a talk in the MillerCom series tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock. This is at the Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. That's on the campus. And these programs are always free and open to the public. Anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome to stop by. We'll talk maybe a little bit about what he will be discussing in his talk and also talk about some of the ideas you'll find in the book on deep history in the brain. And questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you have questions, you can certainly call us. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks, David. It's great to be here.
So you spend some time here in the book on Deep History in the Brain talking about historians and how they have and continue to think about history and perhaps how they would answer that question, well, when does history start? Why is it that it seems that it has been, continues to be really difficult to get historians to set, to push back further than this point, you know, roughly, I guess, about 5,000 years ago, when we do start to get to the point where people settle down and we start to see things like agriculture and the beginning of cities and metalworking and writing so that we actually have a record?
Yeah, well, there's, as I'm sure you can imagine, there's lots of answers to that question. And the one that has particularly interested me is the way in which the limitations of in the historical framework, the way the historians think about it, have been are a product of inertia, that history in the Judeo-Christian tradition has always been written in this very short framework. It's sometimes called the short chronology, and it goes back to the idea that the earth was created at a certain point. There's various theories, ideas, dates about when it was created. But if you think about it, if history had been written as a subject that could only be 6,000 years old, once you get the time revolution of the 19th century, it remains really difficult for historians to figure out how to make a plot, to implot history in a time frame that is longer than what they've been used to doing.
Mm-hmm. There continues to be this idea, and there's a phrase, I don't know if this is your phrase or somebody else's, the phrase, no documents, no history. So that is that historians would say, We've got to have something to go on. We've got to have some kind of hard data, and I can do that going back a certain way. But then there isn't anything. So, and I'm sure that historians and other people would say, well, there's just nothing we can say because we don't have material. We don't have accounts of daily life. We can't really do much in the way of reconstructing it. We cannot ask them what their life was like. They can't tell us. So there's just this certain point there's like a curtain drops and there's just no going back. And even once we get to the point where we start to get into modern science, I think a lot of people still say, well, there's nothing we can do. There's just no way to know.
Yes, absolutely. And this was exactly the context in which that particular phrase from the late 19th century was developed, where it came from. What's striking about that particular phrase from 1898 is that the authors of that particular book had known for 50 years or more that there was lots and lots of evidence for what was at the time called prehistoric man that was coming out of the relatively new field of archaeology. So they knew that there was something back there. They were just unwilling to call it history. And this is the idea that history has to begin with documents is actually, in a sense, comes out of this idea of a division of labor. Well, the archaeologists, the biological anthropologists, that's their field. But it's not history. And you put your finger on the major point, David. The reason it's not history is because we can't get at ideas. That was the idea they had in 1898. We can't get at their soul. We can't get at who they say they are. So only when we can get at something that tells us what people are saying about themselves can we have history. And anything before that is just inference, which, of course, was driving the archaeologists mad. But this is how historians were responding to the challenge of archaeology.
Well, and I'm sure even archaeologists would say that there are limits to the material that they can work with as well.
Yeah.
We have fossilized remains of early humans. We have those things, pieces of their material culture that managed to survive. Of course, we know there are a lot of things that were perishable and that are gone. So we have stone tools. We have things like that. And I'm sure that by studying what we have, you can learn all kinds of things about these people and what their life was like. But I'm sure that even for them, there's this frustration that says there was so much more we would like to know, but that we only have so much material. We may have a lot of material, but we only have so much material to work with.
Yeah, and this is one of the things that archaeologists and biological anthropologists tell me all the time. They just look with envy and they say, you can't believe how much we would love to have your sources. And one of the really striking things as I learn more about this field is how actually little evidence there is. In some cases, we're dealing with dozens or maybe in the range of several hundred skeletons and skulls, all told. And that is the evidence from which a lot of the genealogy of humanity's descent from primates has been derived from. It's actually a very small number. This is particularly true for Neanderthals. We have not nearly as many evidences as I guess I used to think.
Yeah. Well, just taking off from that point, say, you know, we have the skull of an early human. So maybe there are some things about that person's brain we could tell. I suppose we could tell how big it was. Maybe we know something about its structure and so forth. But we can't really look at it. We can't do a brain scan of that person because we don't have their brain anymore. But what seems to be you're saying is that we can't study their brain, but we can study ours. And in fact, it hasn't really changed all that much, given that it's a long time has passed, that we can learn some things. We should be able to learn some things about what their brains were like actually by looking at ours.
Yes, there's a number of ways in which you can tease out the evidence. And as I think you said earlier, David, it's always inferential. It's always teasing out clues from the fragments that we have. The size of the brain is important. It's also the shape of the brain. The experts in the field can gather certain clues from the way in which the case is expanding in certain areas as opposed to other areas, particularly the frontal cortex. I have to say, by the way, to inject a thing here, that in my book, actually, I don't go into much of this evidence. The work is much more philosophical and methodological, as you've seen. So this is more in teaching and in current research that I've looked at these issues. The most significant thing about how the brain works is partly as the field of evolutionary psychology in its various shapes would argue. Yes, the modern brain is to some extent also the ancient brain. And we can figure out a lot of things about how their brains work based on how our brains work. The other field that I actually find more interesting is the studies that are coming out of the fields of primatology, because there was a last common ancestor, and depending on which species or genus you're looking at, we know roughly how far back that last common ancestor with the human branch, where that split took place. if you actually look at how primate brains behave, you can do a lot of really interesting extrapolation and figure out, well, what's changed with the human brain? What's changed with the human descent? And therefore, you can get some sense of what the selection pressures were on the human brain and start to extrapolate a kind of a history out of it. It's partly what I'll be talking about in my talk just briefly this on Tuesday.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Daniel Lord-Smale. He's an historian at Harvard University. He's the author of the book On Deep History and the Brain. The publication is published by University of California Press, and it's now out in paper if you want to take a look at it. He's here visiting the campus. We'll give a talk in the MillerCom series. This is tomorrow afternoon on the campus, and anybody who wants to stop by and hear him can feel welcome. Also on this program, questions are welcome, too, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. So it seems that what you're arguing, what other people have argued, is that that our experience, our life experience going back into the past, that is environment, the things that we lived through, had a very important role in shaping the brain. And that then, again, this is, I suppose it's a kind of a reverse engineering then. You look at the brain, you look as it is, you look at the brains of our closest animal relatives, then you can from that start to think about what the conditions were that were in place then back then that ended up shaping the brain in these particular ways.
Yeah, that's an approach that the evolutionary psychologists have taken in particular. It's not a path that I've followed. I've been more interested in developing a slightly different way of thinking about this. And the way that I've looked at it, and I don't want to present too much of what I'm doing tomorrow, sure. But I'll give you the sort of a foretaste of it. The real issue is that there's some parts of the brain, some systems that really are absolutely universal. And we know this in part because they're shared with primates, they're shared with mammals, they're shared with birds, all up and down the spectrum. If you look at the way that neurochemicals like dopamine operate, the way that testosterone operates, serotonin, it's pretty much the same in a lot of the higher mammals. That really is one of those universals that we can grab a hold of and say, yeah, this is shared by everyone. What's so remarkable, though, about human culture, and this is true for animal culture as well, is the way in which those systems get attached to different stimuli in our own modern culture. So one of the examples I give in the book is this lovely story when Darwin is in Tierra del Fuego, and he finds himself really disgusted by this person he calls a savage, because the savage had come up and touched a piece of dried meat that Darwin was eating, and he was, how can I eat this meat after this savage has touched it? And then he noticed on the savage's face that he was clearly disgusted by this really unpleasant-looking food that Darwin was eating. So something like disgust, which has a high degree of universality in human cultures, clearly can be attached to many, many different kinds of objects, because culture plays a really important role in determining what kinds of things, in this case, we're going to be disgusted by and what things we aren't going to be disgusted by. Mm-hmm. So I've been really interested, and this is just a brief introduction to the fact that I've been really interested in the way in which culture itself can get programmed in the brain. And once you realize that, you realize, well, the panoply of human cultures that have arisen in the last 50,000 years, especially the last 10,000 years with agriculture, medieval culture, once you start to think about that, then you can say, well, we have this universal architecture, but these changing cultural forms that actually change the brain and the nervous system and the way in which it operates in really significant and interesting ways.
Yeah. You also have some interesting things to say about people's apparent tendency, and something that goes back a long time, to engage in mood-altering behavior, either by things that they take. So we know that people have been doing that for a long time, and we still do use mood-altering substances like alcohol and nicotine and caffeine and other things, but also put ourselves through mood-altering experiences. So maybe that says, well, why is it we like coffee, why we smoke, why we take drugs, why we like to ride on roller coasters, why some people like to do rock climbing, all sorts of things that people do, because one way or another, they get a charge out of it.
Absolutely,
that leads to this question, well, why exactly would they do that? What is in the experience that they would go out of their way to do that and to have that whatever is going on in their brains have that thing going on.
Yeah, that's a really striking point. And I've gotten more, as I've read more and more on brain science, I've really gotten interested in looking at my own body and how it behaves. And there's two things that I really noticed recently. I can think vividly back in the last 5 or 6 years. One was going to an IMAX film. Mm-hmm. We were watching it was a plane that was flying over the South China Sea. And all of us, I'm sure it wasn't just me, had this weird experience of dizziness, in part because the screen was so large and the scene was so vivid. So I was actually feeling these changes in my body. And I knew perfectly well that the director knew mm-hmm. what the effect of the film was. The other was going to the Dia Museum in New York. This is the one that's up on the Hudson. And looking at this modern art, where there was no question that the artist was aware of the effect that it was having on me and my nervous system, my perception. There was pieces of art that I kept wanting to touch because I needed to. There was clear that the art was deceiving my senses, and I needed to check with that to find out what reality was. It was a slightly dizzy experience, and I was filtering this back in and realizing how much in this case of the 20th century or the 21st century, how much of our own culture is actually oriented towards around this. Providing this stimulation or this reward, or in fact this dizziness. So the examples that you talked about are exactly these are all things that feed into our dopamine reward system or mm-hmm. or other basic systems in the body. But our culture has created in the 20th and 21st century a whole new apparatus for feeding the dopamine reward system. Mm-hmm. Things that we didn't have before.
Well, it leads to this question about why is it that we should. We should feel that should feel so satisfying that you would actually want to replicate some aspects or some response to a situation that, you know, maybe in the dim and distant past would have been something that would have come out of extreme threat. Why is it that you – obviously something – we got to like that, obviously, because we're trying to recreate it. But that, you know, that leads me to think. Well, what exactly were the original conditions in place that was in response to? And then also maybe then the next question is, well, how is it that we ended up on some level recognizing that as pleasurable to the point where it got built into us, so that now we actually want to do that to ourselves. We seek out opportunities to have that. Feeling, you know, why is it that we enjoy? Well, I don't enjoy it, but you know, some people enjoy putting on a parachute and jumping out of an airplane, and get to the point where it's just, you know, they want to do that as much as they possibly can because they get a jolt out of it.
Yeah, I don't have an answer to because it is so personal, and clearly one of the things that's interesting about the way in which our modern economy works, our modern system for offering pleasure to people is that it actually appeals to across the sort of neurophysiological spectrum. Mm-hmm. So the people who want to be able to get a high from climbing or from sky jumping can do it, and those of us who prefer reading a book or listening to the radio can do that. So the system that you're talking about there, and I'm not a neuroscientist, so I speak in layman's terms in effect, but the system we're talking that you've been mentioning there is the system that feeds adrenaline or epinephrine into the system. It gives this jolt of you know this stimulation, this stress, and it's a temporary reaction. As I understand it, the reason that some people find that particularly pleasurable is because it's followed by the other kinds of neurotransmitters and hormones, in particular endorphins, which are the body opiates. It's an opiate-like substance that's produced in the body, as well as dopamine, which is the major part of the reward system. So do you see what I mean? It's not the actual moment of stress that's pleasurable. It's the feeling. It's the chemicals that are then produced by the body afterwards. Not all of us have that particular sequence. In other words, I don't skydive. I don't think I ever really want to.
No.
So for me, it's really – for all of us, it's really just a question of finding the things that appeal to us.
Yeah. It's sort of – it you do it because it feels so good. after you've survived.
Yeah, exactly.
We're getting close to our midpoint here. Our guest is Daniel Lord-Smail. He's professor of history at Harvard University. He has maybe two main areas of interest. Medieval European history is one, but this thing that we're talking about here this morning is another, deep history, the idea of, can there be history? Can you do history if you go back before there is an historical record? And he says, well, yes, he thinks that you can do that, and in part by taking a look at modern things like modern genetic science and neuroscience, and that if you're interested in some of these ideas, you should look for the book on deep history and the brain. We have some callers here to bring them into the conversation, so why don't we do that, starting with someone in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Good morning, David. Mm-hmm. Good morning, Professor Lord-Smail.
Good morning.
I'm so glad you mentioned climatology, because I had the great pleasure of attending the Planet U conference here at the U of I on climate change last week. And there were a number of presentations that dovetail precisely into this field. One particularly was just really fascinating. It was done by Peter Domenical, who is at Columbia. Mm-hmm. And it was a look at the African humid period, its abrupt end, and the cultural implications of the transition. And I can't hope to give more than like a brief thumbnail sketch, because it was just a massive presentation. It was great. It drew in information from a variety of fields, but I'll try to go through it really quickly. Okay.
Sure.
The African humid period was a period from about 1500 BC to 5000 BC. The entirety of Africa was covered in vegetation, which I had no idea of in the first place.
It's extraordinary.
The Sahara,
yeah.
Changes in solar radiation patterns changed the monsoons, which brought the rains to the northern part of Africa, which covered the entirety in grasslands and forests, and everything looked like sub-Saharan Africa. So when you look at the cultural implications of that, you get small-scale hunter-gatherer civilization that spreads throughout the entirety of the area. And they noticed by doing radiocarbon dating of sites, small human settlement sites, all throughout the eastern sections of what's now Sudan, Egypt, Algeria, all of these areas. And what they found was that, so the African humid period ends very abruptly. The intertropical convergence zone, which is like the northern border of the monsoon area, just sort of snaps shut like a trap, and causes the massive desertification of North Africa in a very, very short time frame. And that time frame coincides precisely with the rise of the pharaohs in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
You get the end of the African humid period at 5000, first pyramid emerges at 4500 BC. Which is just a fascinating idea, because it implies resource deprivation. This reliance in the Nile Delta on the seasonal floods. You know, they have to come. If they don't come, you starve. You can't rely on a nice steady stream of precipitation as you had previously. And so the implication there is that the beginning of history, the move of people into cities, the rise of kings, the beginning of what we know as civilization was engendered at least in part by resource deprivation, and that given our druthers, we would all probably prefer to live like little hunter-gatherers. And when you look at history, this is repeated in many areas. Among the Maya, the largest, most wealthy centers of Maya civilization were those where the rains were most scarce and most difficult, unreliable. You know, that they lived in areas of precipitation extremes, which gave power to the kings who asserted this right to this connection to heaven that brought the rains. So, I don't know. I never considered that idea, and it sends my mind spinning off in like a million different directions. It makes me think of Freud's civilization as discontents. This idea that there's this, you know, pre-Stone Age mind in the back of our heads that chafing and struggling underneath all of the constraints of civilization, and that maybe needs to be fed with the dopamine-enhancing activities in order to remain satiated. I don't know. I don't know quite where to go with it in terms of the question. Look at the deep neurology between some of the few remaining hunter-gatherer societies, like Jared Diamond's New Guinea Highlanders, and versus, you know, just city dwellers and seeing, I mean, are there changes in the brain structure there? Are there changes in the dopamine reward pathways that exist given the circumstances in which you grew up?
Yeah, I think those are exactly the right kinds of questions. And for a lot of them, we're certainly getting answers coming from fields of climatology, fields of archaeology. What you mentioned was the arguments that have been developing about why, let's call them large coercive civilizations emerge. It's congruent with a parallel argument about how agricultural the transition to agriculture happened in the first place. This used to be viewed as an extraordinary celebration of the human mind, finally figuring out that you can grow food as opposed to chase it and gather it. And the trend nowadays, and obviously there's disagreements in this as there are in all fields, but the trends nowadays is to assume that humans are dragged kicking and screaming into agriculture, largely owing to growing overpopulation and resource deprivation, in particular foods, animals were running out. There was problems with the climate that you mentioned. This is the younger dryas movement, a shift in the climate that caused severe resource deprivations all throughout the Middle East in particular. And parallel things are developing in the New World, archaeology as well. So what it is taken out is this element, this new research has taken out this element that the shift to agriculture and the shift to civilization was a triumphant step forward, and replacing it with this is the last gas solution to environmental crisis. So thanks for your question.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things you saw about that was also that the authorities, their power was very strong but very brittle, because when you had failures of the floods many years in a row, or failures many years in a row, their reason for existing, their entire justification for extracting these massive tribute and tax payments from their people disappeared all of a sudden, and the large cities like Tikal in Guatemala just disappear overnight. It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, it is.
Anyway, I'm taking up too much time, but thank you so much.
Thank you for the call. Let's go next to someone else. This is Effingham, line number 4. Hello.
Yes. Hopefully, there are some answers. if you could address the evolution of humans of both sexes in the fields of dialectics, sexuality, and the emergence of paternalism. I'll ring off and listen. Thanks.
Well, clearly that's a really large question. I'll only give sort of one corner of an answer to it. There's some really interesting work done by a primatologist, Sarah Blaffer Hurdy, and a whole school of thought of which she is a part, which has been really interested in breeding and mating in primates, but then extrapolating from this evidence to early hominins using what little evidence we have for morphology, sexual dimorphism, things like that. Hurdy's argument is, which he's really just developed powerfully in the last few years, is the idea of a cooperative breeding hypothesis, namely that what really makes human breeding distinctive and therefore human mating distinctive is the way in which females desperately, importantly rely on the help of other people, she calls them allomothers, to raise children. And what Hurdy has argued is that this impulse, this shift to cooperative breeding, harnessing the resources of a large network by each woman to help her raise offspring, was the thing that caused human society to begin to crystallize as something different from previous primate societies around about 2 million years ago. This is argument that she's developed. And there's a lot of congruent evidence and arguments that have come out of biological anthropology and primatology. So the what's interesting about this, and the point that Hurdy and others make, is that 50 years ago, everyone assumed that culture was literally a man-made thing. It was men who made culture. And what Hurdy and others are arguing is that culture and society can largely be seen as a woman-created thing.
Are you know one of the questions that people in various fields, historians, I'm sure, philosophers, anthropologists, all sorts of people have thought about for some time is they're interested in whether or not there are fundamentals in human nature that transcend time and place and culture. And people have argued that that there are various things. Is that a question that interests you? Is that part of what you're trying to get at?
Well, it interests me as a historical question about why did people ever get distracted by this question in the first place? Because as everyone knows, it's basically a very ill-posed question that you can't have a human nature without biology, and you can't have, by the same token, you can't have biology without human nature. One of the on that particular score, one of the examples I'm going to just discuss briefly tomorrow, which is this is the rhesus macaque experiments done at the University of Wisconsin in the 1970s, took young rhesus macaque monkeys, neonates in fact, and isolated them from their society for 3, 6, 9 months, and then just put them back in to see what would happen. And the result was that they all turned psychotic and failed to be members of society again. So even an individual cannot survive in this particular experiment without all of the stimulus that society and culture provides. So the question of nature versus nurture, in a sense, we've gone beyond that. The two are so interdependent.
Let's talk with someone here in Champaign County where we are. This is line two. Hello.
Hi. The previous questioner on the idea of patriarchy and matriarch or earlier times, I wanted to know the spelling of the person you were citing, and I gather there's not much that you can say that you've come upon that has anything that says anything either way on that, because we have this. The prehistory, it's so hard to say anything about it. Just the name of it actually makes it clear of that, I guess. But we have these ubiquitous goddess sculptures in Europe that sort of imply that there was some different attitude towards the feminine or something than certainly medieval times, but when they were burning them. The other thing that you may not have anything to say about either is, again, it's talking about since you do talk about neuroscience, there's this theory of bicamerality and consciousness as once the other in oneself discovering one. I'm not recapitulating it very well because I really don't know what to make of it. So I was wondering whether you had anything to say on that. On that idea.
Sure. The author I was speaking of is Herdy, H-R-D-Y. And the book that I've always used is Mother Nature, but she's just come out with a new one, in fact, literally just been published, which is a synthesis of her work. I should mention again that my work has largely been almost as a historian of science. I'm interested in the way in which historians have thought about their own time and why is it that it's been difficult for historians to think with the deep past. And I'm interested in ways of bringing the neuroscience into history. My feeling on that score is that history has always depended on psychological theories, sometimes consciously, sometimes unconsciously, and that it would certainly help history if it were brought up to date with current trends in the study of the mind. I mean, that's a very general statement about how I use neuroscience. The figurines you're mentioning were the Venus figurines, which one finds after about 45,000 years ago as modern humans move into Europe. The question of matriarchy versus patriarchy is really rather thorny one. The most important thing to mention here is that among Australopithecines, there was a really big size difference between males and females. The males were generally about 50% larger than the females. And with the emergence of modern hominins, in other words, with the emergence of our genus, that gap drops rather rapidly to about 10 to 15%. Males generally 10 to 15% larger than females. But it doesn't budge. It stays there for 2 million years, and it still is about there. So what the biological anthropologists will say is that there was a lot of pressures causing actually men stayed about the same size and women got larger. But there is the typically you have larger males when you have dominant males that are dominating breeding. And so in species where the bodies are the same size, you tend to have pair bonding. So that gap of 10 to 15% is interesting. It more or less suggests, and I'm going to translate very coarsely and roughly here, more or less suggests that we just can't get away from patriarchy. And that the way we get away from patriarchy is cultural and not biological, I guess is one way of putting that. So, for my part, I wouldn't rely too much on the Venus figurines, although one thing that is important is how much women did provision in terms of their food gathering in the Pleistocene. That seems to be fairly well established. And then finally, I'll just briefly mention your argument. The book that you mentioned is Julian James.
It's not my argument, but I would like.
Yeah,
to
sorry. No, your observation. This is
previous subject.
Yeah, this is Julian James.
The size isn't the only thing that is power structure is not necessarily. I mean, certainly size is a big factor, but guile is another one, and intelligence. So
yeah, absolutely.
And cooperation between. I think that suggesting that because men are the male species or the male phenotype, whatever it's called, genotype, I guess, is larger, then doesn't necessarily mean that translates directly into a power structure and a patriarchy.
Nope, you're right. And because I'm a historian who works normally in medieval Europe, I don't feel qualified to actually have an opinion on that. I just mentioned that as one of the data points that we need to think about. The last observation you made concerned Julian James's famous book, The Origins of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind, the idea that the two halves of the mind were actually neurologically split for much of the human past, and then came together in a rather startling transformation that created culture. And this was something of a cult classic when it came out in the 1960s. To some extent, that argument has been recapitulated in some of the arguments by Richard Klein and Derek Bickerton and others, arguing that there was a sudden genetic change about 50,000 years ago that created the possibility of symbolic thought, symbolic culture. I find these arguments intriguing, and again, I'm not an expert enough to have an opinion worth listening to on it. I tend to think that they replicate to some extent the Garden of Eden story, that modernity comes out of a sudden creation, and whether it's genetic or God-driven is, you know, either way in the narrative, it works in the same way. So I tend to like histories that don't posit sudden creation moments and can just drift back, depending on your subject, almost as far back as you want to take them. You know, that's why I'm interested in body chemicals, because they go back 200 million years.
Well, one last note on that is that, you know, the similarity, the structural similarity of the argument might actually buttress it in some ways, as opposed to saying that we may dismiss it because of that.
And sure.
Maybe there is an insight in that.
Absolutely.
Prior argument about reality and consciousness or something that isn't the God idea that it could easily, you know, be the same. If that makes any sense, thank you.
It does. I just don't feel qualified to have a strong opinion about that. The one thing I do suspect, if there was a sudden genetic change, we should find it somewhere in the genome, and with enough studies with ancient DNA comparing the modern genome to the ancient genome. Eventually, if there was a genetic change, we'll find it.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Daniel Lord-Small. He's an historian at Harvard University. He's here visiting the campus to give a talk. This will be in the Millercom series tomorrow afternoon, and it takes off on some of the ideas that you will find in his book on Deep History and the Brain, published by the University of California Press. It's now available in the paperback if you'd like to read it. Questions are welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, it seems to me that because in thinking about prehistory, because at least to date, now we may have more good hard data, but at least to date, we were working on a relatively small amount of data, which forced you to do an awful lot of inference. You know, you had to spin a story based on maybe not very much. And so given that, is there really any way to get the kind of pollution that comes with, you know, whatever kind of political ideology, you know, whatever kind of baggage you bring to the very problem of trying to figure out, you know, what can we say? I mean, is there any way to strain that out so that then whatever you come up with has more validity in and of itself, you know, not because we're putting stuff on there, but because that's what really is.
Yeah, and this is really the great $64,000 question. The first point I'll make, David, is that I'm a medieval historian. I'm used to spinning out arguments from very little evidence, right? So to some extent, it actually is quite logical that those of us working on a period before about 1500, as the documentary record tends to get thinner. Actually, I work on a fairly rich source base, but if you go earlier than 1200 or so, it starts to get thinner and thinner. So our methods are actually, in terms of how we spin arguments out of fragmentary evidence, actually very similar to the way that archaeologists or biological anthropologists would. There's a fundamental congruence in the way in which we have to argue. We don't fully appreciate the way in which medieval scholars actually, in a sense, are at the cutting edge of inferential argument making. The second point is that there has been in the fields that do paleohistory. I tend to call it paleohistory nowadays, as opposed to prehistory, early history. In the fields that do paleohistory, there's been a real revolution, and maybe that's too strong a word, but in the quantity of information that we now have. And a lot of it comes from the various ways in which we can tease evidence out of the genomic evidence. In particular, all of the things that we now know about the migration of humans all around the globe, which we used to only know from archaeological evidence, can now be buttressed or tested by the genetic evidence, because the genetic evidence gives us really good ideas about when people are moving and where. So, for example, when the questioner was asking about the Sahara, one of the things that in theory would be possible to track would be the gene flow out of the Sahara. If you were, I'm not sure how you would do it, but it's one of those things you can actually follow in the absence of documentary evidence of censuses and other things like that. Mm-hmm. So that is added because it can test the archaeological record, in other words, the bones and tools and things like that. It gives us two perspectives on what was happening. And if they're congruent, then we can say pretty clearly, yes, modern humans from Africa arrived in Europe 49,000 years ago. When they don't match up, then we have areas where we want to pursue further research. Now, it's not just the genomic evidence. There's other kinds of evidence coming out of isotopic evidence. For example, the isotopic evidence that comes out of tooth enamel. You can take a cross-section of a tooth and look at every single layer of enamel that's laid down in babyhood. And you can know, based on the chemical signatures in each layer of enamel, where essentially that individual was and where that individual grew up. So there's a great story. Actually, this is not a story about paleohistory, but about the Anglo-Saxon period of there's a body in Stonehenge that clearly, from the tooth enamel evidence, was known to have come from, I think, the region of the Swiss Alps or something like that. And this, you know, even from my period, this raises really interesting questions. Well, how did it get there? What are the patterns of mobility that made this possible? I could go on more, but essentially, that because of the growing array of evidence and the growing ability to date things with precision, which is another complicated, interesting story, we have a much, much more robust history. Still fragmentary, but enough to actually be able to call it history and therefore put it in sequence with what we usually call history and say we're going to have a human history that's 2 million years old as opposed to just 6,000.
Yeah. How did you, as someone who was and continues to be the historian of medieval Europe, get interested in paleohistory?
Well, that's a really complicated and interesting question, and it's really just personal and situational. I think I was reading Jared Diamond and Steven Pinker in the late 90s, and like a lot of people, just finding it absolutely fascinating to think with. I was teaching a course just for personal reasons on which I called a natural history of humankind, just for the wild fun of it, more or less. And I was having to do research. I was having to think about the question, so how do I present this as history to my students and not as archaeology, not as anthropology, but something that can connect with what my students were thinking of as history? So I designed and taught a course, which I've taught now 3 or 4 times, which starts more or less with Australopithecines and comes down to the 19th or 20th century usually, in obviously in small little bits and pieces. We can't do everything. And then finally, I even in my own specialized research, I've long been interested in emotions, which is part of the way in which the brain works. And because emotions surface in very interesting ways in medieval texts and documents, and we've been looking at them for several decades now in a very, very serious way. And there's a lot of literature getting at what the emotions do in human societies, what humiliation does, what disgust does, which provide for me, at any rate, really natural points of connections to this larger literature on the brain and how the brain emerged and how emotions emerged as social glue and as things that pull societies apart as well as pull them together.
Yeah. Well, it's we here on the program within the last, few months, I've had two conversations with two different psychologists who are very interested in emotion. Paul Ekman, who is probably one of the top guys in study of emotion, and Dacher Keltner, who is one of his students. And in probably both those conversations, we talked about some of the work that had been done, particularly that Ekman did, to try to answer the question, is there something universal about emotion or is that cultural? And essentially, as based on the experiments he went out and did, he really came back with the conclusion that, no, there is something universal about emotion and that everybody seems to experience the same kind of things in the same kind of ways, and that the way we display emotions, generally speaking, is very recognizable to another human being. So then I suppose that says, well, if that's true now, that probably emotions and the same kind of emotions and the same sort of emotional experience has been part of human existence, who knows how far back, probably a very long way. Maybe knowing things like, disgust, love, lust, anger, happiness, sadness, those sorts of things have probably been with us for a very long time. What does knowing that do for you?
Well, for me, it gives me because I agree with Ekman. I like his work a lot, and he's not actually how would one put this? There's a lot of people in the humanities and some of the social sciences that will disagree strongly with Ekman. I happen to agree strongly with him on this particular issue. For me, what the universality of it allows, me to think about the particularities in what is much more an interesting way. And I guess the way I would describe that is that knowing that you can find something like anger and disgust in all human societies makes me attuned to the way in which it is operating in, say, a medieval culture that looked different from the way it's operating in our culture. Because just to go back to the example of disgust, which I talked about earlier, the fact that we all have it doesn't mean that it's always used in just the same way in every given culture. So Ekman is describing a disgust reaction, which is the sides of the mouth dropping and the eyes squinting and things happen, which is absolutely universal. But it's culture that then harnesses disgust to particular inputs. So when I start to look at, the question you might start to ask is, well, what things were disgusting in the Middle Ages and how was disgust harnessed in particular circumstances? And one of the things I began thinking about are the stories that have come out from the fabulous work of Carolyn Walker Bynum about medieval female mystics who would lick the pus from plague sores and would kiss leper wounds and things like that. It's a very disgusting kind of reaction. And what's interesting is the way you can think about this whole culture evolving among female mystics precisely because they are leveraging this, kind of disgust reaction. They're overcoming their own what presumably was their own disgust at something as a way of shocking an audience. To go back to what you were saying about adrenaline surges, is it a way of shocking an audience, of stimulating them, of making them really aware of the depths of their piety?
We're almost at the point where we have to stop. We have been talking about this question of when does history begin from the perspective of current, the historian of the present day. Just, I wondered, does this question interest you and asking it in the within the frame of paleo history, and to say, well, is there history until you can actually understand and appreciate the fact that there is past and there is future? I mean, when in the mind of people does there start to be history?
Well, that probably we can't know unless we have texts, although we can suspect. The historical sense, in other words, the capacity to think about the past and to frame your identity in terms of the past, can be done through history. We can think about the ways in which a Cubs fan, for example, can think very, very closely about the history of the Cubs and identify with it and mm-hmm. agonize with it, and how this is something that shapes the identity of a Cubs fan. The question that arises is whether you need formal academic history in order to have that historical sense. And if you stop and think about it, if you think about, for example, many of the great epics and sagas of the Middle Ages, these are genealogical histories. These are histories of connecting people with past events, where the behavior of the current day is measured by the behavior of the past day. A lot of this, as we know now, is all part of oral culture. It doesn't have to be written down in any way. So I think we can legitimately argue that there has been history in the sense of genealogy in connection with the past, really as long as there has been language and symbolic reasoning.
Well, we're going to have to stop. But for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Daniel Lordsmail, he'll be giving a talk in the Millercom series, Is Culture Just a Drug? History, Neuroscience, and the Great Transformation, tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Spurlock Museum in the Knight Auditorium on the U of I campus. These programs are always free and open to the public. Anyone who is interested should stop by. Also, you'd like to read more on the subject we've been talking about, you can look for his book on Deep History and the Brain, published by University of California Press. Thanks very much.
Thanks, David.
Appreciate it.